Maine Calling's Your Vote 2020 coverage is brought to you by MEMIC, AARP of Maine, and the law offices of Joe Bornstein.
A conversation with Jay Allen, Republican running for Congress. As part of Maine Public's Your Vote 2020 coverage, Maine Calling is hosting conversations with each candidate on the ballot for U.S. Senate and U.S. House of Representatives. Today we'll speak with Jay Allen, the Republican challenging Shelley Pingree in Maine's 1st Congressional District. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Allen, a family practice physician who lives on the Midcoast, is a strong supporter of President Trump. He has made headlines with his opposition to the mask-wearing policies of Governor Janet Mills and the bonus unemployment benefit during the COVID-19 pandemic. He supports gun rights and lower taxes. What are your questions for Republican Jay Allen? Join me and Maine Public's political correspondent, Mal Leary, for a Your Vote 2020 conversation, next on Maine Calling. But first, this news. This is Maine Calling, and I'm your host, Jennifer Rooks. Co-hosting with me this week, Maine Public's senior political correspondent, Mal Leary. Today, a Your Vote 2020 conversation with Jay Allen. He is a Republican running for Maine's 1st congressional district seat in the U.S. House of Representatives. We invite you to submit a comment or question. You can send an email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post a comment on our Facebook page. And a few programming notes before we begin this conversation. For the rest of this week, we will be interviewing the other candidates for Maine's 1st and 2nd congressional districts. We will not be taking live calls during these interviews, but we encourage you to leave us a voicemail in advance with your question or comment for the candidates. That number, 207-370-3487. Tell us your first name, where you live, and what you want to ask. Again, the number, 207-370-3487. Maine Public will return to the Judge Amy Coney Barrett confirmation hearings immediately following today's Maine Calling. If you'd like to hear those hearings live, you can do so by going to the Maine Public website. Jay Allen, thank you for joining us today.
Yeah, you're welcome.
Mal, I'm going to let you start with the first question.
Jay, COVID-19 continues to claim lives here in Maine, across the world, and medical experts say one of the most effective defenses against the virus spreading is wearing a mask. Yet you, as a medical doctor, have opposed requirements on masking. Could you explain why you're right and those other doctors are wrong?
Well, actually, experts are not coming to my position. So about 9 days ago, there was a statement that came out of Great Barrington that was put out by epidemiologists from Harvard, Oxford, and Stanford. And they're talking about the same thing I've been talking about for 6 months now. The shutdowns and the policies that we put into place are doing more harm than good. And so they suggested opening things up. They suggest what they called focused protection, where you protect those who are most vulnerable. And we know who those people are. Those are the elderly, and those are people who have underlying health conditions. You protect those people, but you let other people live normal lives. You let them go to school. You let them go shopping. You let them go to restaurants. You let them do normal activities. And part of the reason they suggest doing that is because we actually decrease the risk to the people who are at risk by allowing people who have low risk to get infected and develop herd immunity. That's what Sweden did. They developed herd immunity, and they are pretty much done with the virus now. All we're doing here is we're kicking the can down the road. We are not getting rid of the threat. We're just delaying the threat for another couple weeks. The other issue I have with the face masks is that we're requiring everyone to wear face masks. Now, during most of this summer, the county where I live, which is Lincoln County, we had a handful of cases, two, three cases, pretty much the whole summer. So if you assume that 50% of cases don't have any symptoms, that means you had five, at most 10 cases that whole summer in a county that's 14,000 people. It does not make sense to mask every single person. The other thing that we see is that asymptomatic people are much less likely to spread the virus. They tend to have lower virus loads, and they are not as great a risk of spreading the virus.
So, Jay, so it seems to me that, this is Jennifer speaking, that President Trump's recent COVID diagnosis and hospitalization didn't change your opinion at all.
Not at all. In fact, the statements that are coming out recently are saying that we need to open things back up. And that's the Great Barrington Declaration. That's the World Health Organization just a couple days ago. They said that these shutdowns and lockdowns are the wrong approach. Those should be reserved for when we are getting overwhelmed, when the hospitals are getting filled, when the ICU beds are getting filled. We have not reached hospital capacity or even come close to it at any time here in Maine. And those when the that's when those types of lockdowns should have been implemented.
I'm curious, though, about the that you said only protect those with underlying conditions. The number one underlying condition, from what I understand, and you're a physician, you can tell me if this is wrong, is obesity. And the CDC reports that 42% of adults in America are obese. So it's not very targeted to just given that one underlying condition, never mind the many other underlying conditions that put people at risk.
Yeah, the biggest risk factor is age by far. The vast majority of deaths have occurred in people who are over the age of 80 or 70 at least. So once the younger you get, the less risk there is, even if you do have some of these other factors. But some of the factors that place you at greatest risk are cancer and severe immunocompromise. Those are greater risk. They may not be as numerous, but they are a greater risk for having severe problems if you do catch the disease. I mean, we know that President Trump is obese, and he weathered this very well. And a lot of people are doing very well. It does increase your risk a little bit, but it's not a severe risk for those who catch it.
Mel?
Congress has provided several measures to mitigate the economic impact of COVID-19, including a cash payment to most Americans. In your judgment, is more stimulus needed? And if so, what's your priority for that aid?
The most important thing we can do to stimulate the economy is let people get back to work, bar none. I mean, it does not make sense to keep people at home when it is safe for them to return to work. And it is safe for them to return to work as long as you're still protecting those who are at high risk for catching this disease. So that is the most important thing we can do to get people back to work and get the economy moving again. But, you know, talking about stimulus programs doesn't make sense when people can go to work, because that's what works best.
What is your specific solution? Oh, I'm sorry,
programs.
Mal, go ahead. Go ahead, Mal.
So none of these various programs that are out there that even the president is supporting, you think are needed, that we should just let businesses reopen, and that's going to solve the problem?
Yeah, we should open back up. And if we had not shut down, we wouldn't have the problems that we have now. So that was an error mostly at the state level, but also somewhat at the federal level, because they recommend shutting down. The 2 weeks at the very beginning, that made sense because that was a time to prepare and get things going. But this dragging on of these shutdowns has been devastating. And people have been begging for months. You know, since April was one of the first protests that was put out to get things opened back up again. If we had opened things back up then, we would not have had the problems we have. The tourist industry would have been saved this summer if Governor Mills had not kept things shut down the way she did. So
Jay,
it's really...
Alan. How many deaths is okay? I mean, we're past 200,000 in the U.S. In your view, how many is okay?
That's the wrong question. because no matter what you do, you're going to get death. No matter what you do, we are seeing increases in suicides. We are seeing increases in overdoses because of what we're doing. And part of the reason we have death is because those deaths have come from Democrat-controlled states that sent unhealthy people to nursing homes where they could infect other people who are at high risk. They did not protect the people that needed to be protected. So you're asking the wrong question. That's a leading question, and that's an inappropriate question, and it's the wrong question. We see that if you are in Sweden, they had very low numbers of deaths, and they had a very open policy. So that's a leading question that is inaccurate and false, and I resent it.
It was just a question.
Yeah, but it's a leading question. You're saying that my policy will increase the number of deaths. It will not. What has increased the number of deaths is Democrats who send sick people into situations where people are at risk. The most deaths, I mean, 90% of deaths have occurred in 30 counties. 30 counties, and they're all controlled by Democrats. So by saying that what I'm proposing is going to increase those deaths is wrong, because there are counties all over this country that have had open policies and have not seen the deaths that we saw in New York City, New Jersey, and other places.
You know, would you talk so much about the cases being concentrated in areas controlled by Democrats? Don't you run the risk of politicizing what really is a medical issue?
You're talking about me politicizing this? I think it's already been politicized. It's been politicized because, you know, you look at what country or what states are closed down and which ones are not. The ones that are closed down are Democrat-run states. The ones that are open are Republican-run states. It's already been politicized. To ignore the fact that it's been politicized would be irresponsible, because it has been politicized. And it's not me making it political. It's the whole country that's making it political.
Well, let's broaden out the question then and ask you about the Affordable Care Act. Do you want to repeal the Affordable Care Act as President Trump has proposed? And if so, do you want to replace it with something? And if so, what would you like to replace it with?
The problem with the Affordable Care Act is that it's misnamed. It is the most unaffordable thing that we have done for healthcare in a long time. And it was designed that way on purpose. If you go back and look at the testimony against the Affordable Care Act, we warned that it would not be affordable, that by the time we reached the 10-year period that they had implemented, it would be unaffordable for Americans to pay their premiums and pay their deductibles. And that's a matter of historical record. And we were right, because we could see where this was going. And the reason it was planned that way is so that people would get into this program. And again, the costs were shoved to the end. So they get into the program. It looks good for a couple of years, but then the costs start to go up. And as the costs go up, they'll start saying, well, this isn't working. We need something else. And then the plan was to use this as a step to get to single-payer health care, which now they're calling Medicare for All. So it was planned from the very beginning for it to be unaffordable. And that is wrong. That is government messing with our health care and making it unaffordable so they can take over control of health care. That's wrong. What we need to do is put patients back in control of health care. You know, having the insurance companies in charge of health dollars is not beneficial to the patient. But having the government is not going to be any better. You just change an insurance company bureaucrat for a government bureaucrat. You need to get the patient back in charge of how their health care dollars are spent so that they can make the choices that are right for them rather than having some bureaucrat, insurance or government, make that decision for them.
So how do you get there? You know, what's your proposal to return, if you will, put the patient in charge?
one of the biggest strategies that you can do is increase the scope and capacity of health savings accounts. You allow people to have control of those healthcare dollars, and those are tax advantage dollars, so that that money goes further. And that allows them to comparison shop for the best value for their money. And that allows them to get better quality healthcare, often at a lower price than what they're getting right now. And we've seen that in states that have done that. We've seen that in insurance markets that have done that. By implementing those types of programs, you actually improve the quality and decrease the cost.
Jay Allen, do people have a right to health care?
No, absolutely not. And the reason I say that is because health care, if you look at the Constitution and look at individual rights that are delineated in the Constitution, those are things that the government does not provide. Those are the things the government cannot take away. Our constitutional rights are given to us by God. God did not give us health care. In order for us to call health care a right, the government has to get involved. Has to. There's no way around it. The government would have to get involved. It also involves having people perform a service, whether they want to do that service or not, because you're forcing someone to provide health care, because you can't get health care unless someone gives you that health care. So that involves forcing people to do something, whether they choose to or not. So, no, it's not a right. It's a priority, and it should be a priority, but it is not a right. The other thing, too, is that healthcare resources are limited. If you assume that healthcare is a right, for example, kidney transplants, we have a limited supply of kidneys. If you call healthcare a right, then how do we get kidneys for everyone who would need one if we call it a right? They have a right to that kidney, but they don't because we have limited supply. So calling it a right is not the right way to think about it. Priority, yes. Call it a priority every single day of the week. But it is not a right.
Mel?
Let's move on to a different topic. Several studies are projecting that Social Security faces insolvency within a decade or so. What changes do you support to guarantee insolvency? Higher taxes, benefit cuts, accommodation, or what?
Well, you know, there's... basically, I realized early on in my career that Social Security probably would not be there. So I relied on my own health savings, or not health savings, retirement savings to fund my retirement. I'm not counting on Social Security for my retirement. Not everyone has that opportunity, but people need to recognize that there are problems with Social Security. And again, it goes back to the way it was set up. When it was set up, we had a lot of healthy young people supporting a small number of elderly people. But as our population has aged, the size of people who are drawing from Social Security has increased, but the number of people feeding into Social Security has decreased. So you have to recognize that that's a problem. Now, there are a number of things you can do. You can put an income limit. So if people have other resources, you could say, well, you can't draw from Social Security. One thing you could do is delay when you can get those benefits. So instead of getting it at 62 or 65, you have to wait till 70 or even 75, because people are living longer now, too. So that would delay when you could actually draw from those benefits. I don't think we should increase taxes, because that is detrimental to the economy. So I would not be in favor of anything that would increase taxes paid into Social Security.
Okay, and before we go to a break, Jay Allen, I just want to have a little fact check here. The states that have the most deaths, it is true that in the top five is New York and California, but also Texas and Florida, who do have Republican governors. We are going to go to a quick break. When we come back, your questions and comments for Jay Allen, Republican challenging Shelley Pingree in the 1st Congressional District.
Your Vote 2020 programming is made possible by your support and by AARP Maine, providing information on voting from home with absentee ballots. AARP.org/MaineVotes. MEMIC, with a mission to improve workforce safety and injury management, and a goal of sending millions back to the Maine economy. And the law offices of Joe Bornstein, who believe that voting rights are the cornerstone of democracy. Learn more at vote.org/state/Maine.
How can Hollywood tell diverse stories without pigeonholing actors of color?
It's such a tricky balance of unintentional tokenism of like, well, now you get your story. Tell us about your family background.
I'm Elsa Chang, actor Sunita Mani on Diversity and her new movie, Save Yourselves, this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
And that's coming up later today at 4 o'clock here on Maine Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, 10 lessons for a post-pandemic world. We talk with Fareed Zakaria, Washington Post columnist and host of CNN's Sunday program, GPS. In a new book, he considers the long-term impact of the COVID-19 pandemic and lessons the world should learn, including trust science and insist on honest, competent government. Join us.
And that's coming up later tonight at 8 o'clock here on Maine Public Radio.
And welcome back. This is Jennifer Rooks, and we are listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, the Republican candidate for the first congressional district seat in Maine, Jay Allen. Thank you for joining us. I'm joined by Mal Leary, Maine Public senior political correspondent, and we're going to begin our questions from the audience with a voicemail that came in before the program.
My name is Elizabeth. I'm calling from Hallowell. Would the candidate support any attempt to stop the CMP corridor project? Thank you, Jennifer.
So do you want me to respond now?
Yeah, okay. That's a question from the audience. Yeah.
So as far as the CMP corridor, I am torn. I see benefits and I see disadvantages. The benefits are that it is a fairly inexpensive source of electricity. Right now, we're not going to be able to take advantage of that because all that energy is going to Massachusetts if that does go in. There are also consequences to that, too. The biggest one is on the environment along that corridor, and that could be detrimental and probably will be detrimental to that area in terms of that. The other thing about the consequences is that it will affect the biomass industry up northern in northern Maine. So it would have a detrimental effect on that because, you know, if you have this huge amount of energy coming in through the corridor, the energy that normally would have come from the biomass industry would be shut down and overwhelmed. So we would lose jobs and money from the biomass industry if that corridor goes through. As far as my position, I don't take an official position because I don't see that as a federal issue primarily. I see that primarily as a state and local issue. So as a federal representative, I would not have a lot of input into that. Those are really just my personal opinions, but there are advantages and disadvantages to both sides.
Mal.
It's interesting. Do you look upon this as an issue that should be solved by referendum or by a regulatory agency, be that regulatory agency, the Public Utilities Commission, or the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission?
I have not really looked into that issue enough to be able to answer cogently about that. I'm going to have to pass on that one.
All right, we're going to go to another voicemail question that came in before the program.
Hi, this is Pam in Smithfield, and I'd be interested to know if the candidates have formulated any ideas about how they feel public education, especially K-12, should change, innovate, whatever, based on what we've been learning this year. Thank you.
So just for background, my wife and I homeschooled our children for most of the time that they were growing up. Our two oldest started in public schools. But when the oldest was in third grade, second oldest was in first grade, after they finished those two grades, we pulled them out, and the rest, so they were homeschooled the rest of the way through high school and into college. And the other kids only did homeschool during their time with us. And part of that was because of the situation, because we were in the military and we were moving all over the place. So we did not have ready access to the post schools because of the size of our family, we lived about half an hour out from the schools or from the post. So it was partially practical, but also partially because of our decision. The biggest problem I see with the schools right now is that too much of the curriculum is being dictated from too far away. That means nationally mostly, but also state level. It should be the local school districts that are deciding the curriculum. The other thing that I'm seeing, which is a problem with the schools, is that they are doing too much indoctrination. And we see that in terms of the sexual programs that they're implementing. We see that in terms of the social programs they're implementing in schools. We need to get back to the basics, because the basics are what's going to prepare them for their future careers. So the basics, reading, writing, and arithmetic.
Mal.
Would you look at the needs, though? Not everyone's able to do homeschooling. I understand why you did it in the military. That's clear. But how do we reform the public school system to meet those same sort of goals that you've been talking about?
Well, we need to stop teaching to test. We need to stop saying that this is what the kids need to learn and concentrate on helping the kids to learn how to learn. And instead of teaching, well, we need to know these facts, we need to know these statistics in order to be able to pass the criteria that we need to get federal and state funding. So that's one thing. But, you know, it goes back to people, parents, even if they're not homeschooling their kids, should be involved in their kids' education. And with the life, our life, the way it is right now, it's very difficult for parents to do that. But they need to make that commitment and get involved in the schools as much as they can. You know, get involved in parent-teacher association meetings. Get involved in the school board if you have time and inclination. Get involved in school activities. You know, volunteer to coach for a team. You know, get involved.
A lot of the news this year, Jay Allen, has been around the Black Lives Matter movement and the reaction to police killings of Black suspects. And I'm wondering if you believe that there exists systemic racism, and if so, if you were elected to U.S. Congress, what would you do to change it?
So I do not believe that there's systemic racism in the police. I have worked with law enforcement officers throughout my career. A lot of military members, when they leave the military, go into law enforcement. And the law enforcement officers I work with, for the most part, are fine, upstanding people. They care about their communities and they're watching over their communities. What we see in a lot of these situations is we see a lot of Monday morning quarterbacking. So law enforcement officers have to make split-second decisions, and those are life-changing decisions, potentially. And so you can't second-guess them, because we don't know all the situation most of the time. Even with the body cams, we can't always tell what's going on. The other thing that we see is that a lot of times that the narrative is being twisted to make it look like the police are systemically persecuting the blacks. And when you go back and look at the footage and look at the full picture, it's not as clear as the media is portraying it. And then the other issue is that, you know, this Black Lives Matter thing, that is racism in itself. You can't fix racism by promoting racism. Racism, Black Lives Matter is just the opposite side of the coin from white racism. When you say Black Lives Matter and you say that in a way where white lives don't matter, or, you know, if you say white lives matter, then you're racist. You say brown lives matter, red lives matter, yellow lives matter. If you cannot say those in conjunction with Black Lives Matter, then Black Lives Matter becomes a racist statement and should be condemned just as much as saying white lives matter.
Well, let me bring up a statistic then and have you, in Maine alone, although black people are only 2% of state residents, they're 9% of people in prison. Is that not a systemic issue?
It's a systemic issue, but it's not a systemic police issue. It's a systemic issue in the black communities. If you go back and look, the vast majority of black families, and this is a fairly new problem, new meaning decades old, not centuries old. Back in the 50s and even into the 60s, the family was the basis of the black community. That has been destroyed. Now the vast majority of black children are born into single-parent homes. And that has a detrimental effect on the children in that community, but also on the community as a whole. And, you know, there are several black pastors who have come out and said that very thing, that we need to go back to basic values, family values, and encourage men to stay in the families rather than going out and just sowing their wild oats and having a great time. Because children need that stabilizing influence in the family. And until we fix that problem, then we can't fix the problem that is affecting the black community.
Mal.
In your long military career, I am sure you came up against the problem of racism in the military. It's been documented in a number of studies. How did you address that as part of your medical profession and dealing with these folks?
So there were isolated incidents of racism in the Army, but for the most part, I did not see it. You know, I worked with people of all races. Some of my best friends were African-American, and I worked well with all of them. You know, we had a lot of Hispanics in the military, and again, good relationship with all of them. In the military, you really don't care what the color of the skin is of the person working next to you. What you care about is whether they have your back or not. Because when you're out on patrol or when you're out in hostile territory, you want to be sure that the person next to you is going to help you and fight with you instead of leaving you out in the open to be killed. So racism is not a systemic problem in the military either. Again, isolated cases, yes, but not a systemic problem in the military.
Do you believe there's systemic racism in the country in general?
No, I don't. You know, there are some, and African Americans have said this too, this is the country where blacks have the best chance to succeed. If you go to pretty much any other country, they are kept down either by social circumstances or anything else. But this is the best country for opportunity for people of all colors, black, white, red, yellow. So no, there's not systemic racism. Most Americans are good, honest people. Most Americans get along with people of all types. There are some bad apples out there, and those bad apples are in both camps. But that does not mean that we have a systemic problem. There are people who benefit financially from stoking those issues. And some of those are people in the black community who get fame and money from stirring up what they call black issues. And one of those is Al Sharpton.
We're going to go to another voicemail that came in before the program.
My name is Peggy, and I am calling from Augusta. My question is, what is your stand on the newest military organization, the Space Force? Thank you.
Well, I don't have an official position on the Space Force. I think that space is a frontier that we need to explore. But, you know, I don't see that as strategic to our national defense. So I don't see that being a big part of our current strategic defenses. Now, it could very well become strategic in the not too distant future, and it's beneficial to be able to get started in those things. But I see space more as a scientific venture than a military venture.
We're speaking with Republican candidate for U.S. Congress, Jay Allen. We're going to take another quick break. When we come back, more of your questions and comments. We'll be right back.
Your Vote 2020 programming is made possible by your support and by the Law Offices of Joe Bornstein, Maine lawyers committed to working for Maine people since 1974. Learn more at joebornstein.com. AARP Maine, providing information on voting from home with absentee ballots. AARP.org/MaineVotes. And MEMIC, with a mission to improve workforce safety and injury management and a goal of sending millions back to the Maine economy.
On October 13, 1965, Unity College, formerly the Unity Institute of Liberal Arts and Sciences, is incorporated as a nonprofit corporation. The college was founded in 1965 with a faculty of 15 and a student body of 39. The founders, a group of local business leaders, were looking for ways to counter economic decline in the area. In 1969, Unity College awarded degrees to its first graduating class of 24 students. In the 2019-2020 academic year, Unity College's student body included 1,208 undergraduates and 225 graduate students.
On This Day in Maine's History was created in partnership with the Maine Historical Society and made possible through the generous support of Marshall Communications. Happy birthday, Maine! You've no doubt heard the alert's tones before, as the emergency alert system advises you that in the case of an emergency, an important message would follow. Because of Maine Public's statewide infrastructure, we serve as the statewide backbone of this important service and distribute the alerts to all other stations around the state. This is a valuable and important public service that informs, alerts, and warns the people of Maine when situations warrant.
Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling, and Maine Public's Mal Leary has joined us from our Augusta studio. Today on our program, a Your Vote 2020 discussion with Jay Allen, a candidate for the U.S. House of Representatives, the seat that is currently held by Shelley Pingree. We invite you to join the conversation. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org. You can tweet at Maine Calling or post a comment to our Facebook page. Jay Allen, the American Medical Association considers gun violence a public health crisis of epidemic proportions. Do you agree, and do you support a ban on assault-style weapons?
Yes and no. So gun violence is a problem in this country, but it's not a problem with the guns. It's a problem with the people who hold the guns. And, you know, we do need to get guns out of violent criminals' hands, but we should not ban weapons just because some people misuse those weapons. There are more people who are bludgeoned to death than are shot by assault rifles or automatic rifles or semi-automatic rifles, for that matter. So, you know, the Constitution guarantees the right to keep and bear arms, and that is a right that should not be infringed unless you have violated the responsibility that goes with that right. And that's why we need to protect the Second Amendment. Yes, when people violate that responsibility, then yes, they should be prosecuted and they should have weapons taken away from them, but not until they have violated that responsibility.
I need to clarify before we move on. I'm looking at a statistic here that shows in 2019, handguns were the weapon in more than 6,000 murders in the U.S., and blunt objects, 397. So I'm not sure where you got the information that more bludgeonings happen than shootings.
Okay, maybe that's an old statistic, but, you know, we don't talk about banning bats, and bats are used in a fair number of murders as well. And again, a lot of those handguns are used by people who are criminals to begin with. So people who are committing violent crimes and not just murders. I mean, not just out to commit murder, but they're out there committing violent crimes and use those guns in course of those violent crimes.
So where do you draw the line in terms of what's all right to ban for weapons? For example, the Supreme Court has said it's fine to say individuals can't own a machine gun. But how much further down the line, if you will, among all of the weapons that are being made, do you think there needs to be further restrictions?
No, there don't need to be any further restrictions. The way I look at it is the reason we have the Second Amendment is to protect citizens against their country if the country becomes tyrannical. So the citizens should have the same weaponry that's available to the military in that country.
Are you saying that should include machine guns?
The military is not using machine guns. They're using they use guns that do have rapid fire, but they're not using machine guns, at least not extensively.
Does this mean citizens should be able to have tanks?
Negative. No. But there's no reason to limit what we have right now. I mean, automatic weapons have already been banned for citizens. And there's no reason to restrict the weapons that we're able to carry further right now. You know, I would argue that there's no reason in the future to be able to ban those weapons.
Mal, I want to get to foreign policy before we run out of time here. I know that you had a couple questions for all the candidates on the topic of foreign policy. Why don't we steer the conversation in that direction?
Let's turn to probably the most important foreign policy question any member of Congress will ever vote on. What are your criteria for going to war? And do you see a trouble spot out there that's brewing where we might soon have to apply those criteria?
I do not see any areas right now that are brewing. Basically, when we go to war, we have to have a compelling national interest to be able to go to war. We also have to have clear objectives about what we're trying to accomplish and clear objectives about when we say we are done. And that's the problem that we've seen in wars up to this date. We go in, we have an objective, but we don't have a clear end line. You know, it's a broad objective. It's not a defined objective. So that's the biggest problem that we've seen in these never-ending wars. You need a clear objective and a clear end point.
All right. I want to ask you another important issue right now, especially with the Amy Coney Barrett hearings going on, and that's about the right to abortion. Do you believe that the decision on whether to have an abortion is a decision best made between a woman and her physician?
So I believe that people should have the right to choose, but the right to choose should not come at the cost of another human's life. Because the most basic right is the right to life. If you take away the right to life, you have taken away every other right, including the right to choose.
I'm not sure what you mean. If a woman is pregnant and wants to have an abortion, does
she is ending a life. She is ending the baby's life. And there are certain circumstances where that becomes necessary. But the problem is when abortions were first approved, the pro-choice advocates mentioned safe, rare, or safe, legal, and rare. What we've seen is that after abortions were legalized, they have been pushing that boundary so that they're no longer rare. They are now available freely at any time during pregnancy.
What's your stand on long-acting birth control?
I think that that is the best option for people who don't want to have pregnancies. I think, you know, I have used, not used personally, but I have prescribed birth control for a lot of my patients, and I think the long-acting birth control is a good option for a lot of them because they don't have to remember to take a pill every day. They don't have to make sure that the barrier device is used properly and doesn't leak. So those long-term options are very, very good options.
All right. Mal Leary.
Let's go back for a moment to foreign policy questions. That's the nation's intelligence agencies are all reporting Russia, China, other nations are trying to influence the outcome of elections in the United States this year. How should we retaliate, or should we retaliate, against those nations?
Well, I mean, they're going to do that. So the best retaliation is to make sure the elections are secure as much as possible. And you know, that means making sure that people vote in person as much as possible, that we don't do this mass mailing ballots. Absentee ballots is fine, but where we just mail ballots out widely to everyone who used to be registered, who has not confirmed their address in 2-3 years or 20 years since they last registered, we should not be mailing out ballots like that. People should have to request an absentee ballot and then return that ballot. So the other thing we see is foreign meddling. The push to have illegal immigrants vote is a form of foreign meddling. So we need to make sure that only citizens are voting in our elections and that people have come here legally and can vote only legally in our elections.
We'll go to an email from Carl. Do you agree with Justice Thomas that people who have been convicted of minor assault, not with firearms or weapon, in altercation, domestic or otherwise, ought not to be banned for life from owning a gun? That is, a collateral denial of gun ownership under Heller is unconstitutional when the minor felony does not involve the gun as a weapon.
Yeah, I agree with that.
Mal?
Let's ask a political question here, since we've asked a lot of policy questions. According to the latest campaign finance reports, incumbent Shelley Pingree has way outraised you, and you're not getting much support from the national Republican sources. So how could you get your message to the voters in the 1st District with so few resources?
Well, what we're doing is we're running a grassroots campaign. So we are doing a lot of stuff on Facebook, and we have gotten a lot of followers on Facebook, and they are helping to get the message out. We have dedicated volunteers in each of the counties that are helping to spread the message. And you know, I'm thankful to them. But that's one of the things that I recognized was going to be a problem early on. You know, this is my very first time running for politics, any political office. And so I knew that it would be difficult because I didn't have the name recognition. But the other thing in this district is that it's considered a safe Democrat district. So I see the National Republican Committee and all these other committees looking at this race and saying, yeah, he's got a long shot, but do we really want to spend our money there when we have close races that we can make sure that we affect and have a better chance of having a good outcome? But what people fail to realize is that you don't need a lot of money in politics. I mean, it helps, but you don't need a lot of money in politics to be able to make a difference, because I think we will win. And I think a lot of people will be surprised when we do win.
All right. And let's wrap up with a question about climate change. Do you believe that man has caused the climate to change, and what needs to happen?
Well, I mean, I find it interesting that the people who harp loudest about doing everything we can to prevent climate change or stop climate change are the people flying around in private jets, including my opponent, flying around in private jets, but talking about climate change. If we are serious about climate change, we need to address the problem where it's most severe. When you have some bleeding, you don't. So if someone comes into trauma surgery, you don't address the scratch on their finger. You address the gaping wound in their leg, because that's where the bleeding's coming from. And the big problem with climate, or with greenhouse gases, with carbon emissions, is not Maine. It's not even the United States. We have done well in reducing our carbon emissions. Even after we left the Paris Climate Accord, our carbon emissions have gone down. The problem in this world is China and India to the large extent. China much more than India, but India is also a problem with carbon emissions. And so if we're not serious about addressing China and India, then it really doesn't make much point about what we do here in this country, because that's like spitting in the ocean. You know, you're not addressing the real issue. You're addressing a feel-good measure.
All right. We have about a minute left, so I'll ask a question that I think can have a quick answer. This is an email from Simon. There has been quite a bit of questionable things said by Mr. Allen, Dr. Allen. Where does he look for his news information? In the age of disinformation, where does he get his information to make informed decisions?
I read from a wide variety of sources, including the New England Journal of Medicine, Journal of American Medical Association, the newsletter of the American Medical Association, the American Academy of Family Physicians, Portland Press Herald. I get information from Epic News, which is the other side of the news coin, mostly from the internet, but you know, I get my information from a wide variety of sources.
All right. Well, that is the last question today. We thank Mal Leary, Maine Public Political Correspondent Mal Leary, for joining us today. And our guest was Dr. Jay Allen, the Republican candidate for U.S. Representative for Maine's 1st Congressional District. Tomorrow, we continue our series of Your Vote 2020 candidate discussions with Dale Crafts, who is the Republican candidate for Maine's 2nd Congressional District. Again, we welcome your questions in advance via voicemail, the number 207-370-3487. Again, 207-370-3487. Leave your first name, where you live, and your question or comment. Today's sound engineer was Lucy Suchek. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You've been listening to Maine Public Radio, and stay tuned for continued coverage of the Judge Amy Coney Barrett Senate confirmation hearings.